Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine standoffs must end in 48 hours, according to the nation's interior minister. The World Food Program warns of a looming drought in Syria. We continue our conversation on the Global Youth Well-Being Index.
Roughly 85% of those youth represented in our index are actually living in countries with below average youth well-being.
A former Palestinian prisoner may have found a better path to Middle East peace. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yockey. Ukraine's interior minister is warning that standoffs with pro-Russian demonstrators in three eastern regions must be resolved in the next 48 hours, either through negotiations or by force. Arzen Avakov told reporters today that a political solution is still possible, but he vowed protesters who want conflict will get a forceful answer from Ukrainian authorities. Pro-Moscow groups have seized several government buildings in eastern Ukraine and demanded a vote on joining Russia in a dramatic escalation of the protests against the country's Western-friendly interim government. Here in Washington, the White House says it has evidence that some of the protesters are not local Russian speakers, but were brought in from elsewhere paid to start trouble. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke Tuesday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His testimony dealt with recent events in Ukraine, Russia's involvement, and what the U.S. and its allies intend to do about it.
The intense focus on Ukraine continues. And everything that we've seen in the last 48 hours from Russian provocateurs and agents operating in eastern Ukraine tells us that they've been sent there determined to create chaos. And that is absolutely unacceptable. These efforts are as ham-handed as they are transparent, frankly. And quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary engaged in this initiative. Russia's clear and unmistakable involvement in destabilizing and engaging in separatist activities in the east of Ukraine is more than deeply disturbing. No one should be fooled, and believe me, no one is fooled, by what could potentially be a contrived pretext for military intervention, just as we saw in Crimea. It is clear that Russian special forces and agents have been the catalyst behind the chaos of the last 24 hours. Some have even been arrested and exposed. And equally as clear must be the reality that the United States and our allies will not hesitate to use 21st century tools to hold Russia accountable for 19th century behavior. We have stated again and again that our preference and the preference of our friends and allies is de-escalation and a diplomatic solution. But Russia should not for a single solitary second mistake the expression of that preference as an unwillingness to do what is necessary to stop any violation of the international order. At NATO last week, and in all of my conversations of the past weeks, it is clear that the United States and our closest partners are united in this effort. Despite the costs and willing to put in effect tough new sanctions on those orchestrating this action and on key sectors of the Russian economy, in energy, banking, mining, they're all on the table. And President Obama has already signed an executive order to implement these sanctions if Russia does not end its pressure and aggression on Ukraine.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has placed the spotlight on NATO. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnura takes a look at NATO's response to the current crisis over Crimea and eastern Ukraine.
Experts say Russia's military incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea was a wake-up call for the 28-member NATO alliance. Charles Kupchin, NATO expert at Georgetown University, says since the end of the Cold War, the Western alliance has been trying to redefine its mission.
A few months ago, people were talking about an existential crisis for the alliance in the absence of the mission in Afghanistan. The bulk of NATO troops are scheduled to be out by the end of 2014. And the question was, okay, what next? And now I think there is a revival of NATO's traditional mission of collective defense.
That policy stipulates that an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. During a recent NATO meeting, Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to collective defense, saying, "We will deter and defend against any threat."
We have already reinforced NATO's presence on the eastern borders of the alliance. We are flying AWACS surveillance patrols over Poland and Romania. We have more than doubled the number of fighter aircraft allocated to the NATO air policing mission in the Baltic states.
Poland and Romania are NATO members that border Ukraine on the west. Russia has amassed thousands of troops on its border with Ukraine, prompting Western experts to say an incursion into eastern Ukraine is likely. Charles Kupchin says NATO would react even more to protect its members.
You would see a considerable expansion in the moves that NATO has already taken to beef up defenses on its eastern frontier, perhaps even including reneging on the gentleman's agreement that was struck when Central European members entered NATO, which was to say to the Russians, we will not forward deploy substantial numbers of NATO troops in Central Europe.
Kupchin says NATO's reaction will be short of war.
The prospect of a clash between NATO forces and Russia over Ukraine is effectively out of the question. And that's because there has been an assessment on this side of the Atlantic as well as in Europe that what has happened and what could potentially happen in Eastern Ukraine is not the stuff of war. That is to say, war between the Western democracies and Russia.
Sean Kay, NATO expert at Ohio Wesleyan University, agrees. But he says Russian forces will have a difficult time if they enter eastern Ukraine.
There's not a lot we can do to stop them, but their military capabilities are actually still pretty thin. They can do a thing like the Georgia War, but that was a pretty small conflict with highly trained and integrated forces. But to sustain a large deployment of forces over a very long period of time in a hostile territory, that's going to be difficult for the Russians to do.
Charles Kupchin puts it this way.
For Putin to head into eastern Ukraine, he opens a Pandora's box. He risks a civil war on his border. He risks miring Russian troops in something that could look like another Afghanistan.
As a result of Russia's military intervention in Crimea, NATO has suspended all civilian and military cooperation with Moscow. NATO officials say they will review their relationship with Moscow in view of Russia's actions. Andrei Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko, a self-made confectionery magnate worth an estimated $1.3 billion, has emerged as the frontrunner in opinion polls leading up to Ukraine's presidential election scheduled for May. The surveys show the one-time foreign minister well ahead of his main rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Henry Ridgewell profiles the man who has pledged to rescue Ukraine's economy and face down Russia.
Petro Poroshenko is known as the Chocolate King in Ukraine, having built a fortune on confectionery, but he is no stranger to politics. He was a regular speaker at Kiev's Independence Square at the height of the recent protests, denouncing corruption and calling for membership of the European Union. Arisia Lutsevich is at the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
He became so popular during the recent protest because he was giving some kind of confidence in terms of his direct action and also because he was not affiliated with the existing political parties.
Poroshenko has received the backing of opposition leader and former boxer Vitali Klitschko. In a recent interview, Poroshenko said he would build on Ukraine's revolution.
It was born the new country. It was born the new people. But unfortunately, it left old politician. And I tried to do my best that the politician, the government, the authorities, and the president be adequate to the new people from the revolution.
Poroshenko played a big role in the Orange Revolution in 2004, alongside his now rival Yulia Tymoshenko, becoming foreign minister under the then president Viktor Yushchenko. He built his fortune on the back of his giant chocolate company, Roshen, alongside media and manufacturing interests. Observers say he is cultivating an image as a safe pair of hands.
You can come here in a very safe, in a very nice country, yeah, with a very experienced labor, with a very effective cheap cost for the creation of the businesses. And the only obstacle for doing that is the corruption. That's why is it a top priority during the modernization.
His status as a self-made billionaire sets him apart from Ukraine's other business elites, who are often seen as corrupt, says Arisia Lutsevich of Chatham House.
He has good understanding of the way international financial markets are working, and he is on good term basis with a lot of Western politicians. But also, you know, he is somebody who understands Russia, because he's doing a lot of his business with the confectionery and sugar industries are in Russia.
But Poroshenko's relations with the Kremlin are poor, says Russia specialist Andrew Foxall of analyst group the Henry Jackson Society.
His Russian confectionery business was subject to trade sanctions and embargoes by the Russian government. The business lost an awful lot of money. He lost an awful lot of money. More recently, Poroshenko's assets in Russia have been targeted.
Petro Poroshenko has said he will never accept Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea. Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border. Whoever wins the May 25th election, victory will mark just the beginning of the daunting challenges that face Ukraine's next leader. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The World Food Programme is warning of a looming drought in Syria that could put millions of lives at risk. Syria suffered a severe drought in 2008, which persisted into 2010. Vulnerable communities in affected areas of the country barely had a chance to recover from food shortages and rising prices arising from this event before it was plunged into war in 2011. The WFP warns that 6.5 million people could be at risk of acute food shortages, and they will need international aid to survive. WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Burrs tells VOA rainfall since September has been less than half the long-term average.
There is only 1 month left in the rainfall season that lasts until mid-May, and with three quarters of the rainfall season gone, it is unlikely there will be a significant recovery in this agricultural season. I'm just saying that this situation is of concern because it will add another problem on top of the conflict consequence impact for the people who already need urgent life-saving assistance.
The WFP finds dry conditions affecting the wider Middle East will compound the impact of the civil war on the agricultural sector. The report says northwestern Syria, in particular the Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama governorates, are the worst affected. Meantime, UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Fatoumata Lejuna Kaba says a major drought could lead to more displacement.
We can expect more refugees to leave if, on top of the conflict, they feel that their lives are in danger because there is no food. But it's hard to say, obviously, how many, because they could also move to other parts of Syria.
The World Food Programme says it hopes to reach 4.2 million displaced people in Syria with food assistance this month. But it notes it is short of cash, so beneficiaries will have their food rations cut by 16%. The agency says it requires about $41 million every week to meet the food needs of people affected by the conflict in Syria. The International Monetary Fund says the global economic recovery is strengthening. Oliver Blanchard is IMF economic counselor.
Put simply, the recovery is strengthening. We forecast world growth to be 3.6% this year, 2014, 3.9%. Next year, up from 3.3% in 2013.
Blanchard said the recovery across the world is uneven. He said it is strongest in the United States, the world's largest economy, where the IMF is projecting a 2.8% advance this year. Blanchard said Germany, the top economy in the 18-nation bloc that uses the euro currency, will advance 1.7%. The IMF said that for the first time in 2 years, economies in the southern tier of Eurozone countries will have positive, if admittedly still low, growth. He said emerging and developing countries will continue to have strong growth, 4.9%, up slightly from 2013. The IMF predicted 7.5% growth in China, the world's second biggest economy. The IMF sees a 5.4% advance in India, as well as sub-Saharan Africa.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
We reported to you Monday about the Global Youth Well-Being Index that measures and compares the quality of life for young people in 30 nations. Today, we continue our conversation with the director of the study, Nicole Golden, about what was lacking in the lowest-ranked nation, Nigeria.
Nigeria, one of the things that we've seen is, and Nigeria, I shouldn't say, isn't alone, and some of the other countries and towards the bottom of the ranks, the bottom ranks do tend to be filled with some of the lower income economies. And a number of the indicators are infrastructure oriented or systems, you know, system services oriented, where we know low-income countries are less likely to do well than the more wealthy nations. At the same time, we also do see some negative outlook, a more consistent negative outlook among young Nigerians that also contribute to bringing down their scores and bringing down their ranks.
Is there anything that you have deduced from your findings so far?
A number of things that really struck us in terms of looking at the overall scores as well as within the different domains. I mean, the first thing is that the 30 countries that we do cover in this inaugural index represent or host about 70% of the world's young people, so fairly significant numbers in these 30 countries. And what we find is that roughly 85% of those youth represented in our index are actually living in countries with below average youth well-being. So it's pretty significant. And again, it's the emerging economies, the developing economies, the more fragile states that tend to have the largest youth populations. One of the other interesting things that we find is that, importantly, is that even where young people are doing relatively well, as I said, those countries towards the top and in the upper ranks, there are specific challenges that that they see and that they face and that, you know, we're hoping can be better addressed now that they're brought to light through our index. So, for example, there's a global youth unemployment crisis, really, that's affecting countries worldwide. And in particular, Europe has been very hard hit. So countries like Spain, who does, you know, quite well in the overall rankings, really falls when it comes to economic opportunity. So that's interesting. And at the same time, conversely, we see even where young people are not doing necessarily well overall, they are thriving in certain respects and I think have some important lessons learned to be shared. So again, for example, in the area of what we call citizen participation, which is our area that looks at measures of civic and political expression, Colombia is tops the ranks, followed by India and South Africa and Tanzania, countries that don't necessarily perform well overall on youth well-being, but really show a good framework and a good opportunity for young people to engage, and as well as some nice optimism from young people in this respect. So it's really some of the most interesting things we see. One other thing I'll mention is that in terms of sort of across the 30 countries looking globally, what we find is that on average, countries, young people are doing better in health and least well in terms of economic opportunity. Again, the economic opportunity piece, not necessarily so surprising given the unemployment crisis and the fact that young people were really so hard hit by the global recession. But the health was quite an interesting finding in that really two-thirds of the countries scoring, you know, well above average on the health indicators. showing that I think a lot of the global investments that have been made in disease prevention, in reducing HIV, in childhood nutrition, are paying off for young people. I mean, there's still a ways to go, and there are still gaps, but that was something interesting and positive that we were glad to see.
Nicole Golden, Director of the Youth Prosperity and Security Initiative for the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the International Youth Foundation. You can see details of the report by visiting youthindex.org. The protracted Middle East peace process is in danger of stalling yet again as Israel reneged on the planned release of another batch of Palestinian prisoners and the Palestinians renewed their bid to gain United Nations recognition of a Palestinian state. One former Palestinian prisoner may have found a better path to peace. After spending more than 20 years in an Israeli prison, he now teaches Hebrew to Palestinian children in the West Bank. Sadassa Hoke has that story for VOA Television.
In a classroom of Palestinian 10th graders in the town of Taibe, Ismat Mansour encourages his students to discuss the advantages of learning Hebrew, the language he learned while serving a 22-year prison term in Israel. He was among dozens of Palestinian prisoners who were granted an early release last year in a deal brokered by the United States. Mansour was sentenced to prison as a 16-year-old for helping three older teenagers stab to death an Israeli settler in 1993.
When I was released, I passed in front of the place where the event took place, the killing of the settler. I felt that I had closed the circle at this point, and now I have started a new cycle of my life as a free person who suffered for a long time. I lived through a very hard experience, but this made me gain insight and a belief in the Palestinian cause, but more importantly, that justice should be carried out in a humane and a just way.
Mansour says Palestinians and Israelis need to engage in a debate to resolve their long-time conflict. He says Palestinians will be better equipped if they understand Hebrew, the dominant language of Jews living in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Mansour says he would never again resort to killing, but that he has no regrets.
The real violence here is the violence of occupation. It forces us to resort to violence. I don't feel regret for what I had done because there was an expression of my thoughts at that age and an expression of the political conditions at the time, but I would not do that now.
Many Israelis are not convinced, especially those whose family and friends fell victim to violence. Itzik Mizrahi's brother Haim was 30 when he was killed in the 1993 murder in which Mansour was an accomplice. Mizrahi is one of those who oppose his government's decision to release Palestinian prisoners.
Every time that prisoners are released, we feel that they can continue their lives. They can build a house, a family, get money on a regular basis. But we remain without my brother. My brother did not get to see his own daughter. They can raise children of their own. We are the only ones who have lost. Only my brother lost.
Israel-Palestinian talks have again run into hurdles as the sides cannot agree on several crucial issues, including the release of Palestinian prisoners. Mansour is working with a group of West Bank journalists to establish a website in which he would cover Israeli affairs. He also is hoping to start a weekly radio show about the Israeli economy. Claritza Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
The Connecticut Huskies have won the U.S. Women's College Basketball Championship with a 79-58 win over Notre Dame in Nashville, Tennessee. The win capped another history-making season for the Huskies since head coach Gina Aramea took over the program in 1985. Connecticut now has 9 Collegiate Athletic Association titles and finished the season with 40 consecutive wins and no losses for its 5th undefeated season. Brenna Stewart, the National Player of the Year, led the Huskies with 21 points. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 9th, 1626, English philosopher and statesman Sir Francis Bacon died. When charges of corruption forced his retirement from government service, he turned to literary and scientific activities and is known as an advocate of inductive reasoning and the scientific method. On this date in 1682, the French explorer Robert La Salle claimed the lands around the mouth of the Mississippi River for France, renaming the territory Louisiana in honor of King Louis XIV. In 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee met with Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia to discuss terms of surrender. The surrender effectively ended America's Civil War, a conflict that resulted in over a million casualties. In 1867, the United States Senate agreed by a single vote to a treaty purchasing the territory of Alaska from Russia. In 1914, the first full-color movie was shown. The film shown in London was titled The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. In 1939, noted singer Marian Anderson performed to a crowd of 75,000 gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Anderson had been denied entrance to the racially segregated Constitution Hall, but had been invited by the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, to sing at the memorial. In 1940, Nazi Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. In 1959, the U.S. space agency NASA introduced seven astronauts to the public. They would take part in America's first manned space program, Project Mercury. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. leadership at the 25th United Nations Human Rights Council, or HRC, helped to keep the council at the forefront of efforts to promote and protect human rights. The United States successfully led two resolutions at the recently completed session, one that renewed the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, and another focusing on accountability for human rights abuses and violations in Sri Lanka. For the first time, the Sri Lanka resolution called for a comprehensive investigation to be led by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights into alleged violations and abuses of human rights and related crimes committed in Sri Lanka by both sides during the civil war from 2002 to 2009. With regard to Iran, for the fourth year in a row, the HRC passed a resolution condemning the deplorable human rights situation in Iran. The HRC passed a resolution on Syria, which extends the mandate of the Syria Commission of Inquiry for another year. In addition, the resolution condemns in the strongest terms the widespread and systematic violence by Syrian authorities and government-affiliated militias, as well as human rights abuses by anti-government armed groups. It also calls for the immediate release of all arbitrarily detained persons, improvement in prison conditions, and access for independent monitors. With regard to North Korea, the HRC voted to condemn the country for its ongoing human rights violations and to continue to collect information on abuses. On Burma, a resolution was adopted calling for the renewal of the Special Rapporteur's mandate in order to maintain a mechanism for international human rights monitoring in Burma. Particular concern remains regarding the treatment of Muslim minorities. The U.S. and 41 other countries joined together in support of the Ukrainian government and called on Russia to ensure access and protection for UN and Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe human rights monitors in Ukraine. And finally, with regard to Venezuela, the U.S. called on the government there to end violence against protesters and release those detained for exercising their right to peaceful protest and free expression. The United States, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, will continue to speak out on behalf of people who stand up for their universal rights, and we will stand up for those who are deprived of the opportunity to be able to stand up for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.